Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up, a Wisconsin congressional representative just introduced legislation to ban fracking on public land. We'll get the details.
First, Wisconsin's investment in its local roads has slowed. According to a new study from the Local Government Institute of Wisconsin, local roads are the key to the state's economy, but spending on those roads isn't keeping pace with the rest of the nation.
The quality and funding of the state's highways have gotten a lot of attention lately, in part because the governor's recent budget proposed borrowing $1.3 billion to fund them.
While the state and interstate highways may be important, they cover just under 12,000 miles, while county highways and municipal roads span more than 100,000 miles.
Here to talk about funding for local roads is Todd Berry, author of the study and president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. Todd, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Well, we've heard a lot, as we said, about transportation funding at the state level. What's the situation of road funding at the local government level?
Well, and that question is really why we teamed up with the Local Government Institute to do the study, because there was a lot of talk about how the state sources of revenue for transportation were declining and that the need for greater funding in the future was growing, and all we were doing is borrowing. So we focused on the local element, and counties and municipalities are caught in a bit of a vice, because historically they would get state shared revenues, which since the mid-90s have either been frozen or cut. They used to be able to rely more on state road aid from the transportation fund, but the amount of the transportation fund that's going to local road aids has been dropping, along with the pressure on the transportation fund. And then finally, local governments are levy limited by the state. So unless you have some new construction, you can't raise property taxes. So what's been happening at the local level, the last year we had available was 2012 at the time, is local governments being caught in a squeeze are maintaining what they have to maintain, police and fire protection. And one of the things that they're skimping on the margin, is street maintenance. And we saw between 2000 and about 2012 that per capita street and road spending in municipalities had dropped from $275 a person to more like $220. So that's not an inconsequential drop. And our rate of spending growth at the local level is basically ground to a halt. And as a result, our rank has gone from mid-20s in the country to almost last.
So does that translate into you're out driving and you're going to see more potholes on that county road or on Main Street in the nearby town?
Well, I think on the margin that's true. I mean, as time goes by, if we don't fix the state's transportation fund some way, either we've got to spend less at the state level or we've got to find some alternative to just simply borrowing, then over time, wanting to keep essential services, locals and counties are going to, and municipalities are going to have to continue to skimp a little bit on streets, and that will eventually be seen.
And in this report, you say this is not just a local convenience issue, this is an economic issue. And you made the case in the report that Wisconsin, among other states, compared to other states, is particularly reliant on roads for our economy. Why is that?
Yeah. Well, if you look at three industries, manufacturing, and we're number two in the country, agriculture, where we're historically high, and the trucking industry, which actually we tend to be a little bit of a trucking center, too. If you look at those three sectors, and you'll note I'm not even including tourism here, you have close to one quarter of all the wages paid in the state. And so transportation, adequate transportation systems are really pretty much at the core of the state's economic health.
Talking to Todd Berry from the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, looking at a new report on the state of local and county roads in Wisconsin and how they're being funded. Finds a shortfall could be a problem in the future, according to the report. Well, let's look towards solutions. Are we going to see more money going to local roads anytime in the near future from, say, the states, Todd?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the conclusions we came to in this study was we were pretty candid with municipal and county officials. We said, given the state's past history since about the turn of the millennium, we can't see a lot of evidence that they're going to renew their commitment to road aids. They're becoming a shrinking part of the transportation budget. At the same time as our borrowing keeps going up, debt service is becoming a larger and larger part of the transportation budget. It's already about a fifth. It's pushing a quarter, and that's going to crowd out things that we used to spend money on. And so as a result of that, we started suggesting local options where they could say, okay, we can't count on the state. What can we do for ourselves? And the obvious one that comes to mind right off the bat, not popular, admittedly, is the wheel tax, because it's already in state law. Not a lot of counties and municipalities use it, but I think it's very interesting that last year, one of the state's major cities, Appleton, went to a wheel tax, $20, if I recall, and one of the more significant counties, Chippewa County, did as well. And I think that's a sign that they're recognizing they can't defer maintenance forever, and they can't count on the state either. And they don't want to increase property taxes, of course.
I was going to say, Todd, this is an issue you encounter a lot in your line of work. What's going to upset people more? Bad services, in this case, bad roads, or a tax increase. So either way, if I'm a local government official, I'm going to hear about it.
Yeah. Although I think it's interesting, one of the reasons the city of Appleton went to a wheel tax is because they were getting a lot of pushback on special assessments to property to maintain streets and curb and gutter sidewalk. And when that happens in a particular part of town, it's a special property tax hit, and it's a big one. And people across the city, I think, came to the feeling, which is perhaps a little less painful, a really big one-time property tax hit from special assessments, or maybe all of us sort of sharing in the pain a little bit each year through a wheel tax.
Speaking of sharing the pain, another recommendation in the report, some kind of regional solutions, regional transportation authorities, they've been called in the past. Not always popular with a number of state lawmakers, though. What would you like to see happen, though? How would this work?
Well, let's be clear. We were not proposing any kind of regional transportation authority. In fact, we were not recommending that the state impose anything. What we said is that we thought that if local governments continued to be under this transportation pressure, that you might begin to see municipalities and counties, or some combination of thereof, band together and form regional transportation cooperatives. And what we were saying is that if the state would just specify the minimum amount of population or minimum area that one of these areas could be, that would allow the transportation cooperative to access revenue sources that they, as alternatives to the property tax, that they don't now have. And part of the proposal was perhaps totally giving up the property tax to fund local transportation. The beauty of that is the decision bubbles up from the bottom. Citizens and local governments make the decision, and the state doesn't sit there with a stick or a mandate. It has a carrot that might get us to start making transportation decisions down at the local level, but in a more cooperative way.
Todd, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's Todd Berry, president of the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance, author of a new study on funding for local roads in Wisconsin. You can weigh in on this, by the way, over at the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest says minority groups are targeted for an out-of-proportion number of traffic stops, and that's adding to nationwide tensions between police and minority communities.
First, Wisconsin Congressman Mark Pocan from the 2nd District co-sponsored legislation last week that would prohibit fracking on public lands.
Pocan joined with fellow Democrat Jan Schakowsky from Illinois on the bill, which would ban fracking, the use of fracking fluid or acidization for the extraction of gas or oil on federally managed land. Pocan and Schakowsky introduced the bill last week on Earth Day.
Representative Mark Pocan joins us now. Representative Pocan, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, why do you think we need a bill to ban fracking on public lands?
Well, you know, fracking is definitely something that I think there's a lot of questions that are still out there around the practice. We've seen two states just recently implement bans on fracking. Another state put a two-year moratorium on it. We know that there's a toxic mix of chemicals that go into the ground in order to do fracking that can potentially have pollution into the groundwater. We know that people's fire, literally their water is caught on fire in some areas. We know there's more earthquakes caused in areas of fracking. And there's a whole lot of other concerns around air and water and other safety around fracking, but also around the wells themselves, where there's still some worker safety issues that aren't resolved. And yet we're moving full force into this. It's something certainly has produced a lot more gas and both propane-type gas and actually gasoline out of the fracking process. But we have real questions about the process itself and whether or not it's safe. And since we have jurisdiction over federal lands, of which 90% are open to be leased for fracking, we thought this would be the best way to try to address those issues and guarantee the best safety for people who live around those areas and to protect those areas.
Do you think that we do have enough good science to make decisions about fracking as it stands today, or are there still questions that you think need answering before we make final safety and regulatory decisions about fracking?
You know, there's a lot of questions still. Recently, the agency that oversees this put out some rules around fracking in public lands, and while they largely addressed methane release, which is one of the potential problems with fracking, they took this argument that I strongly disagree with, that the chemical, the toxic chemical mix that goes into the ground is somehow a trade secret, and we can't know what's going into our groundwater. And for people who live around those areas or people who enjoy those areas, if you don't know what pollutants are being put in, certainly that could have health and other risks. And we have a real strong problem with not knowing what that is. In fact, I even hear that throughout the district, just with the chemicals that are being transported on trains. I've heard it from the mayor of Madison. I've heard it from the Ho-Chunk Nation. I mean, they're very concerned about not knowing what necessarily is going through, because it's some kind of a combination of these chemicals that could be very toxic. So that's one area we're really concerned about. And just recently, last week, a whole bunch of news around earthquakes happening in areas that don't normally have earthquakes, but that are being caused by fracking operations. And we don't know exactly what that means potentially down the road. So there's still a lot of questions around this. And I think the best we can do, at least around our federal lands, since so much is open to being fracked, we should have the ability to say we're going to put a ban on it until we really get our heads around the science. And that means some of the companies that do this have to be honest with the public about what's going on.
Now, you're just in this bill looking at public lands, federally managed lands. Specifically, what kind of land are we talking about?
All the lands that we have that are federally owned throughout the country, quite a bit of land. Right now, in fact, about 90% of that land is eligible to be used for oil and gas leasing, and only about 10% is reserved for conservation, recreation, wildlife, and cultural heritage. That means at the end of last year, 34 million acres of public land had leases on it, and another 200 million acres land could still be targeted for drilling. And right now, we know the industry is putting up about $720 million into fighting these efforts in different areas around fracking. But we just have serious concerns that aren't being addressed, and fortunately aren't being addressed, we think, adequately by the department that oversees the public land. So we wanted to put this legislation forward.
We're talking right now with Democratic Representative from Wisconsin's 2nd District, Mark Pocan, about some new legislation he co-sponsored that would ban fracking on public lands. And I'm assuming you can't frack, say, in the Grand Canyon, that we're looking more at things like national forests, say.
Right, but it is about, again, 90% of that land that we have. So it's a large amount that's open to this, and that's why Jan Schakowsky and I have introduced this bill. We have about 10 or 12 now, I believe, co-sponsors on this, but we just dropped it recently, and we're just right now trying to start that education process. We had Secretary Jewell in to a Progressive Caucus meeting, and we talked about this, and there are a lot of people who are very, very concerned around the chemical mix that goes in the ground, but also the water contamination through that, the air contamination, the earthquakes, and also some of the worker safety issues around these wells. And I think we need to get answers, especially if it's going to be on land that's really done with taxpayer dollars.
One thing you mentioned there that you're concerned about, I know, is that the safety of wells for fracking and the inspection regulations in place there. What are you worried about with well inspections?
Well, we think they're not adequately inspected, and that creates more potential for disastrous accidents. And again, because it's on our land, we have a special responsibility to when they're doing this. I know there's some other legislation, I think, that's been introduced to try to raise the rates because it's a fairly reasonable rate to be able to lease this land, period. But again, our responsibility comes with that, that we have to make sure that there aren't toxins being put in, that workers are safe, and those are just some of the concerns that have come out of this. Now, granted, some states have got such concern that they've done outright moratoriums in their states on all fracking, including private land. What we're looking at addressing specifically is the public land that's owned by the federal government.
Now, we live in an era when Americans are increasingly aware of issues surrounding dependence on foreign oil. Is it maybe worth trading some public land for more domestic oil and gas production?
Well, we're willing to trade it, 90% of it, right? That's what's currently available. But that trade-off shouldn't be saying, well, okay, to not get as much foreign oil, we're going to put toxins into our groundwater and into our land in order to extract it. We really do need to get better information about what this is. And the industry, I think, has been extremely remiss by just kind of going away with this line that it's a trade secret about what chemical mix is going in the ground. And I think people have a lot of concerns about whether it's carcinogenic, whether or not it's really leading to things like groundwater pollution and air pollution. And the fact that they don't want to even work with us on this gives us even greater concern.
Now, you've been saying that 90% of public lands are available for fracking, only 10% are set aside. Do you know what percent of that 90 actually has fracking going on currently?
Yeah, I think it's something like 37 million acres are currently currently leased, and there's another, I believe it's 200 million that could be leased under those percents. So still lots of potential for expansion in this area. All the more reason we want to get our hands around this. Actually, it's 34 million acres, I'm sorry, that are currently leased.
As you've been talking about, you know, there are a couple of states who have banned this. The state of New York has moved to ban fracking entirely on environmental and health concern grounds. What do you think of that decision?
You know, I think that's their decision because certain states have a lot more fracking than others. I mean, Wisconsin doesn't really have fracking occur here at any kind of a level. However, we do have a lot of sand extraction because our sand in certain parts of the state is the exact perfect shape for the fracking process. So we've seen some issues around that, but the fracking process itself, whether it be, you know, states like Pennsylvania and Maryland and New York and other areas where they're seeing other negative side effects that come out of this, both to property values, groundwater, et cetera, that's, you know, a decision they've made, and hopefully they're doing it based on the best science possible. My argument is I can't even get the best science possible because the companies involved don't want to share that. And if they're not going to share that, we're operating a little too much in the dark for my and other people's preference.
Is there an approach that you'd like to take from a legislative perspective that would get at some of the issues that you're looking to get more transparency about the chemicals used, for instance?
Well, and that's actually some of the very questions we brought up with Secretary Jewell. I mean, even though I know they came up with a new set of rules largely around the methane release, I think there were at least a half a dozen of us who very strongly expressed our concern that we don't know about these toxic chemicals that are going into the ground and what that means and are they carcinogenic and all the rest, because we can't get that information. And the fact that the industry is telling the United States government it's a trade secret, it's proprietary, you know, I mean, I've been in business for, you know, 28 years. I mean, there are certain things that truly are what you'd call a trade secret, you know, and under intellectual property makes some sense.
But there's other things like this, where if they affect the public health, we need to know what's going in the grounds. And hiding behind that, that's not what uniquely makes you a fracking company. You know, having the equipment that can extract these is really the largest thing that makes you a fracking company. But somehow arguing that chemical mix, that special sauce, so to speak, is the trade secret, I find very disingenuous, and that's part of our concern, is that we can't get more information about it, largely because these are chemicals that could very likely be toxic.
Now, would your bill affect existing frac sand operations or just companies who are looking to frac going forward?
Well, it'd be any future leases, because I think currently if you have an existing lease, it's harder to affect that. But again, since there's 200 million acres that are potentially able to be leased, it would help us to put, I think, pressure on the industry to realize that if they want to continue to do what they're doing and getting a pretty good deal on federal land to do so, we at minimum just need to know the basic questions about what's going into groundwater potentially. Are they potentially causing earthquakes? Are we potentially causing worker safety? What's going into the air that shouldn't be going into the air? Just real basic sort of public health concerns and public safety concerns that I think they should be willing to share with us, because it's a profitable industry. There's no question, but we have to make sure that it's not just profitable for them and expense going on to the general public.
And just briefly, as we wrap up, as you know, frac sand mining has been a big industry here in Wisconsin. There's been controversy about it, people worried about environmental damage, safety, and also jobs and money maybe coming into the economy. Do you think Wisconsin should allow and encourage frac sand mining?
Well, yeah, I know one of the other concerns that's been brought up to me is, you know, our problem with getting railroad cars of other products, whether it be agricultural products from Wisconsin, leaving the state, getting access to rail cars because of all the sand, getting coal to our power plants, or getting pulp and trees to our paper mills in the state. All are having a problem because of the amount and the amount paid, because it's so profitable for the sand to go. So there's a number of other concerns also that we have had conversations with the industry about in Washington, and I hopefully will get resolution that will be short of having to have a legislative fix.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That was Wisconsin Democratic Representative Mark Pocan joining us to talk about his new fracking legislation.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. Tensions between police and minority communities have been at the center of the news over the last year. There have been protests around the country, from the police-involved shooting in Ferguson, Missouri, to today's funeral in Baltimore of a man who died in police custody. And Wisconsin has seen protests, too, over police-involved shooting deaths in Milwaukee and Madison.
These and other incidents have led to allegations of institutional and individual racism and led to calls for changes in the way police and minority members interact. Our next guest is focused in on one interaction in particular, the traffic stop.
His research finds major racial disparities in particular kinds of traffic stops, and that there are major lessons to be learned from these encounters between the police and the public.
Charles Epp joins us now. He's a professor of public affairs and administration at the University of Kansas, and he's co-author of Pulled Over, How Police Stops Define Race and Citizenship. Chuck, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here, Rob.
So why are traffic stops an important place to examine racial disparities in policing?
Traffic stops are one of the most important interactions between officials of the state, you might say, and members of the public. And in traffic stops, we see ongoing tensions between police officers and, in particular, minority racial groups. What we did in our study was to survey members of the public, drivers in particular, about their experiences in police stops. And the survey results were especially revealing about these racial tensions.
Yeah, what did you find? You keyed in on an area around Kansas City, similar findings in other places around the country. What did you find when you surveyed drivers?
Yeah, what we did was to ask drivers whether they'd been stopped by the police in the past year. And that gave us an indication of who is being stopped and for what reason. Then we asked drivers to tell us what happened during the stop. For example, were they given a ticket? Were they searched? Were they handcuffed? Were they arrested? And so forth. And we also asked them, how did the officer speak to you? Was he or she respectful? Was he or she sarcastic, professional, and so on? And from all of those questions, we found something really quite striking, and it was this. There are really two different kinds of police stops that people experience. On the one hand are what we call ordinary traffic safety stops. These are stops in which the officer has observed the driver going 10 or 15 miles over the speed limit and simply wants to sanction that bad driving behavior. In that kind of a stop, the officer walks up to the vehicle, announces the purpose of the stop, and then pretty quickly returns with a ticket and lets the driver go, and it's all over in just a few minutes. The other kind of stop is quite different from start to finish. We call these investigatory stops. In these stops, the officer walks up to the vehicle, and if they announce a reason for the stop, it's commonly a very small technical violation. So, for example, 2 or 3 miles over the speed limit, failing to signal a lane change long enough before you've made that lane change, a burned out license plate light or something like this. But very quickly, the officer moves on to ask the driver what the driver almost inevitably regards as pretty intrusive questions. What are you doing in the neighborhood? Where are you going? Oh, you're going to work? Well, then you wouldn't be carrying any drugs on you, would you? No. Well, then would you mind if I search your vehicle? These investigatory stops are criminal investigations from start to finish. And here's the striking thing. We found that in traffic safety stops, black drivers are no more likely than whites to be stopped. They're no more likely than whites to be given a ticket. They're no more likely than whites to be searched. But in this second category of stop, investigatory stops, black drivers are nearly 3 times more likely to be stopped than whites. And they're 5 times more likely to be searched. They're dramatically more likely to be handcuffed than whites. But quite surprisingly, they are far less likely than whites to be found in a search carrying contraband or an illegal weapon. So racial disparities in stops are concentrated in this second type of stop. So how common is it? We found in this survey that half of the stops reported to us by black drivers in the past year are this sort of investigatory stop. So it's incredibly common. And the experience, in fact, is quite painful and sometimes traumatic for black drivers. In fact, several of the drivers told us that they felt violated in one of these stops, even though the officer never laid a finger on them.
Talking to Charles Epp from the University of Kansas, talking about race and traffic stops. You just heard the basics there. For cause, a safety violation, speeding, running red lights, not much racial disparity. For investigatory, what he calls investigatory stops, looking for something, drugs, say, a really big disparity in who gets stopped, white versus black. So talk some more about these investigatory stops. Are these things that are pretty common around the nation, these, in effect, fishing expeditions to try to find drugs or other illegal possessions?
Yeah, in fact, this is a very common practice across communities across the country. One of the elements of our study was to look at police training materials and professional guidances from police professional associations. Since the early 90s, these sorts of materials have encouraged officers to make these kinds of stops for the purpose of fighting crime, getting drugs off the street, getting guns off the street, and so forth. And they frankly talk about them as, for example, one training manual said, it's a numbers game. You have to stop a lot of people to generate the numbers that will yield some hits, some drugs found, some guns taken off the street. So this is very common. Nearly every study of police stops across the country over the past 10 to 15 years has found that black drivers are more likely to be stopped than white drivers. And our study clearly shows that this problem is concentrated in this practice of investigatory stopping.
Well, I want to get into two big questions here. Does this work, first of all, and what's the damage of this happening? Let's start with the effectiveness. If this is working, if we're finding lots of people carrying illegal drugs, legal guns, as you say, is it worth it?
It's a good question. The police in many communities are quite convinced that it works. The evidence supporting that assumption is pretty thin, I have to say. There was one study done, in fact, in the Kansas City area in the early 1990s, that concluded that there was some evidence to show that these stops improve the safety in neighborhoods by getting guns out of the neighborhoods. But every study since then that has tried to replicate that finding has failed. The second observation to make about the effectiveness issue is that the vast majority of people who are stopped in this way are in fact found to have nothing illegal on them, no drugs, no illegal weapons. And so the vast majority of people subjected to these stops are in fact innocent, and you're not removing contraband, you're not removing weapons with these stops. One very interesting study of stop and frisk in New York City, for example, found that the hit rate, the rate at which guns or drugs were found in these kinds of stops, was in fact lower than the hit rate in random stops, the random roadside check for alcohol, for example. That is a pretty dismal record of effectiveness.
So let's talk about the damage. As we said up front, we're having this conversation in the context of protests, police-involved shootings, a lot of tension between minority communities and police departments around the state. We're following the news in Baltimore today even. Does what you're studying, what you're talking about here, this disproportionate amount of investigatory traffic stops for racial minorities, does that play a role in this distrust, in this tension?
It's very clear that there has been greater distrust among African Americans toward the police than whites toward the police for decades now. We wanted to find out exactly that question, find the answer to it. Do these stops contribute to that distrust? And what we found was, yes, they do, very directly. The experience of an investigatory stop in the past year was the most impactful, the most significant influence on a driver's distrust for the police. Even when you take into account how respectful is the officer toward the person stopped, clearly people want to be treated respectfully. But even when the officer was very respectful, impeccably professionally polite during the stop, if the stop was one of these investigatory stops, intrusive questions, search, and so forth, the driver left feeling, as I said earlier, violated, and ended up feeling much less trusting of the police over time.
We're talking to Chuck Epps from the University of Kansas. He stays with us to talk about racial disparities in traffic stops. He looks into the issue in the book Pulled Over, How Police Stops Define Race and Citizenship.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you see this playing out in your community? Racial minorities singled out for more police attention. What do you think of policies like stop and frisk or traffic stops aimed at finding evidence of crimes as opposed to getting pulled over for a safety violation? If you're a member of a minority community, do you feel like you're the target of police attention? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email talk@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation after a look at the news with Kristen Durst. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We continue our conversation about racial disparities in police traffic stops. Charles Epps stays with us. He's a professor of public affairs and administration at the University of Kansas and co-author of the book Pulled Over, How Police Stops Define Race and Citizenship.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think minority members are unfairly targeted for police attention on the road in your community? Have you experienced this? And if you're in law enforcement, what is your perspective on this issue? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we get to our callers, Chuck, I wanted to ask about the why of this. I mean, I assume police policies aren't saying pull over more African Americans or Latinos. There's accusations that this is individual elements of racism from police. There's people say, no, it's institutional. What leads to this disparity?
That's a great question. Two things lead to this. One is the common targeting of particular areas of town, commonly called high crime areas, by the police for a lot of these kinds of stops. The second is what social psychologists call the process of implicit racial stereotyping. Most of us have in our heads, even if we're not avowed racists, and that's increasingly rare in American society, most people have implicit negative stereotypes associated with race. And officers are no different than the rest of us in that regard. When they're out looking for people who look suspicious, those stereotypes almost inevitably lead them to be somewhat more likely to stop African Americans, especially young African Americans, and especially young African American men than white people.
Let's get to our callers now. We've got Morgan on the line in Lafarge. Morgan, hi.
Hi. I don't really think it's just a race thing as much as it's also an age thing, because in certain communities that I've lived in when I was younger, I know I was targeted because of my age, you know, between like 16 and 20. And then as you know, time went on, you know, that attention from the police definitely changed because of probably the way I looked. So I think that's kind of like a multiplier.
Morgan, thanks a lot. And you had just mentioned, Chuck, black men, especially young black men, more prone. Is there an age element alongside the race disparities that you found in these traffic stops?
Yes, absolutely. The caller raises a great question, makes a great observation. In fact, younger people are more likely to be subject to these stops. Young white men are more likely to be subject to these stops than older white men. What is striking, what we found, so we controlled for age. We took that into account. What is striking is that young white men become far less subject to these stops by the time they turn about 30. African-American men have to reach the age of 50, by our survey results, to have the same exposure to these stops as an under 30 white guy. So age clearly plays a role, and as the caller says, it compounds the other influences, but race is the dominant one. Black people are more exposed to these stops than other people.
Morgan, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Dave in Milwaukee. Dave, hi.
Hi, how are you? Thank you for taking my call. I'm a white man, but my wife and I had adopted my son, who is 5 months old, who's black, and I've had this happen to the two of us. I pull into a convenience store, he runs in, gets a pack of cigarettes, comes out, we go down the road, all of a sudden I'm pulled over by a squad asking me, what are you doing here? I said, well, driving. Where were you? Friend's house. You know, we were patted down, and then when they looked at both of our driver's licenses, see, they had the same last name, they realized it was father and son, but, you know, we were patted down.
Dave, is this something you happened before you were driving around with an African-American youth?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I can tell you episode after episode where just shopping, my son was three, and then all of a sudden I had a floor walker following me. I never had one before, you know, but I had a three-year-old walking my son, walking around with me. Hmm. And so it really got me peeved, so I went around the whole store and filled the basket full and then stopped it. Went back to the guy and said, hey, you can follow me around. You know where this stuff goes. But, oh, yeah, my son's called me, too. They've been pulled over for no other reason than my son was there was a black youth in a car.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call and sharing your experiences. Charles, something you've probably heard similar things to in your research.
In fact, so the book has gotten a fair bit of publicity, as you can imagine, since last August. And I've been doing talking. I get a fair number of emails from people around the country on this subject. And what is striking is the pattern precisely that this caller mentioned. White parents who have adopted an African-American child who, when that child becomes an adolescent or a teenager, start seeing this experience graphically. So for the first time in their lives, they experience, in a way, vicariously what it's like to be African-American on the streets in America.
We were talking about racial disparities in traffic stops with Charles Epp, professor at the University of Kansas, author of the book Pulled Over, How Police Stops Define Race and Citizenship. Well, a worst case in one of these happened recently in a confrontation in South Carolina. Ultimately, someone pulled over, a black man shot by a police officer who has been indicted. Do these encounters provide more opportunity, more chance of that kind of outcome?
Yes, undoubtedly so. Not by any deliberate intent on the part of officers, I must say, but in these stops, there are inevitably some tensions between the driver and the officer, in part because the driver typically feels a bit indignant over the experience. Now, I want to emphasize that we heard again and again and again from our survey respondents, it's very clear that they try not to respond in any way that might provoke an officer to think that they're in danger and to provoke them to use force. Nonetheless, drivers do feel indignant. Officers in making these stops recognize this and so are a bit more careful as they approach the vehicle. Sometimes those tensions, by intent of neither side, do spiral out of control. So this type of stop is certainly the context or the occasion for unexpected tragedies like what happened in North Charleston, South Carolina.
Now, sometimes a response to these kind of encounters is, oh, the driver needs to behave a certain way, or the police officer needs to behave in a certain way to defuse these situations. I believe your book recommends something different. You're looking to get rid of these investigatory stops wherever possible.
Yeah, we think that inevitably there will be tensions if you have a practice, an ongoing practice as a department of making lots of these stops. And the only way ultimately to address those tensions is to reduce the use of these stops to the situations, the exceptional situations, where you really need to make some stops. For example, if there is a serious crime that's just happened in a neighborhood, it may possibly be the case that you need to make some investigatory stops in response to that. But what police departments do instead is to use these in a broad, scattershot kind of way, and that inevitably produces tensions. And the only way to reduce those would be to reduce the use of these stops.
Well, now, outside of the stops, as we said a couple times, there's a lot of tension here over police-involved shootings. You actually got your PhD here in Wisconsin. You know we've had a couple issues in Madison and Milwaukee, going back to Ferguson, Missouri. Is this conversation we're having about racial disparities in police stops part of this climate that's going to make this sort of these sort of tragic incidents, this sense of confrontation happen in the United States?
I don't know that the conversation will make these tragedies more likely, if that's the question. I think, in fact, actually, the conversation may well be the first chance that we have nationally to seriously address the underlying source of the tensions, which in part, as I say, is the ongoing practice of these stops. I'm finding now, I'm pretty closely connected to professional police departments in this area. They are seriously having conversations at the highest levels in American policing now about how to deal with this problem. One proposal is to train officers to be much more polite in making these stops. Many departments recognize that that may not be quite enough, and so they're starting to have a conversation about reducing the use of these stops. That's a good thing.
Chuck, thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to have been here. Thanks.
That's Charles Epp. He's a professor of public affairs and administration at the University of Kansas. He is co-author of the book Pulled Over, How Police Stops Define Race and Citizenship. He joined us to talk about police, minority communities, and racial disparities when it comes to traffic enforcement, especially stops called investigatory stops aimed at finding drugs, illegal guns, and other criminal activity.